Welcome to Ink and Quill, a podcast that examines works of literary fiction from the popular to the obscure. For the next hour, your hosts will discuss their thoughts on a novel, its author, and any subtext that they found particularly potent. Ink and Quill, turning literature inside out.
Okay, welcome everybody to Ink and Quill. So this will be our first official episode. I'm your host, Fizz, and with me is Dr. Hot.
Hello, hello!
Today, for the first episode, we're going to be discussing a novel by Tony Vigorito called Just a Couple of Days. It's a novel about the citywide outbreak of a virus that was gen-engineered by the U.S. military, and they call it the Pied Piper virus.
Well, basically, what I find interesting is that I think this book is the love child between St. John of Revelation, the Apocalypse. St. John meets Douglas Adams.
Yeah, Douglas Adams is definitely somebody I would have thought of while reading the book. And that's probably the first thing that we should talk about is
yes,
the fact that obviously the book deals with some very serious themes.
Yes.
I mean, it deals with, you know, some interesting socio-political problems.
Yes. The subtext is ridiculously rich.
Right. But amidst all of that, the author maintains a very tongue-in-cheek matter of delivery.
And he's wonderful with language. I mean, this author is fantastically well-read. You can see in the subtext references to a rather impressive amount of books, of theories, of, you know, philosophy all around the world. And he's a linguist. I mean, I don't know his background per se, but he plays with words. You know, he's always making, you know, I mean, when he uses a word, an adjective to go with it, he tries to make them so that they sound good together. He is fantastic. It's a wonderful read.
Yeah, one of the things that I like about a book, you know, whenever I read a book, I mainly read fiction,
mm-hmm.
and one of the first indicators to me is always, and it's not necessarily just my opinion either. I mean, I've had many people tell me that the judge of whether or not a book for you is, you know, the judge of whether or not you should read a book is if you read through the first, 5 to 10 pages.
Yeah.
And you can't put the book down, or it's a very quick read, then obviously it's something that you should read. And
oh, yes, absolutely.
If you're suffering, even through the first 10 pages, put it down and go to something else, because it's not your kind of book.
Even the first or second page. I mean, by the first page, by the end of the first page, you should be able to know whether or not it's a book that's going to grab your attention.
And that says quite a bit about the publishing industry to begin with. I mean, as far as, you know, whether or not, you want to take up writing as a profession. But
yep.
Now, I think it's also important to make a distinction there that just because somebody picks up your book and they read the first, you know, couple of pages and they go, ugh, and put it down, doesn't make that person a bad writer.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean,
it just means it's not the right book for that reader.
You know, I mean, that's what I do, you know. I mean, I do literature 24/7. This is my job. And, you know, you're going to have as many interpretations as you are going to have readers. So you can have the same book read by 10, 15, 20 people and have, you know, 10 of them liking it, 10 of them hating it. And it doesn't mean the book is good or bad. It just means that you have a different interpretation.
Right. But back to Just a Couple of Days. I definitely found the book to be a quick read.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Personally.
Although it is not an easy read.
It certainly is not an easy read, meaning that you definitely you definitely want to be kind of up on...
everything, really?
Well, I wouldn't say up on everything, but you definitely need a larger than minimal vocabulary to be able to deal with Vigorito. That's not necessarily saying that he's another Lovecraft.
Oh, no.
Or anything
no.
that...
Not by any stretch of imagination.
Quite that ridiculous. It's not like he's using archaic vocabulary nothing but 75-cent words, but he's chock full of them.
Yes, and
quite a bit in there. Also, I was impressed that I find that a lot of authors that clearly have a good command of language, like he does, tend to go a little bit overboard in the intellectual. And I don't feel like he did. I felt like
I don't think so either, actually.
I felt like he spent quite a bit of time on pop culture reference.
Yep.
Things along those lines that the everyday reader would be able to identify with.
Yes, and that's what I like about him. You know, I mean, granted, I'm a foreigner, so some of the reference I probably did miss, you know. But I mean, if you've been in the U.S. in the early 2000s, because this book was published in 2001, so if you were in the U.S. at that time, then all the reference are pretty clear. You know, movies that were coming out or songs, right. Singers, whatever that were coming out. You know, you can see that in it.
Do you have a copy of the book there near you?
Yeah.
What's the copyright date on that?
I think it's 2001. So I believe it's 2001. Yeah. Yeah.
Obviously, as we're doing this, it is 2009.
Yeah.
So it's
still a recent book.
Still fairly recent. It's recent enough that the references that are made are not out of the realm of most people's
sure
knowledge. If you're in the know when it comes to pop culture things.
Sure. Shall we dig into it?
Go right ahead.
Let's dig.
Nobody's stopping you.
You're ready then. Okay, the first thing that I think is worth mentioning, especially if people are interested in reading it later, is having a look at who are the main characters. You know, who are we talking right about? The main character, the narrator of the story, is Flake Fountain, which, I mean, the names are phenomenal.
The names, once again, are indicative of the author's tongue-in-cheek
yes
method of writing. Every single, anybody who's ever written any, creative work, any type of fiction or poem or,
uh-huh,
a script, a screenplay, something along those lines. Anytime you're writing a work of fiction, it's not an uncommon statement to hear among writers that, God, I hate having to come up with names.
Oh, sure.
Coming up with somebody's name, it's like, I don't care, whatever. And I have a hard time coming up with believable sounding names.
Sure.
Well, one of the things I like about, another book that I was just reading recently,
uh-huh,
did the same thing, where the author chooses names that are obviously fake. I mean, it's just, there's no way anybody would really be named that. Nobody's going to name their child Flake.
Well, but it's
they're
fun.
They're not going to name that. But at the same time,
it's hysterical.
They're named that obviously very much on purpose when you're reading the novel, and the name does give kind of an insight into the personality of the character,
yeah,
just by their name. You know, as you can imagine, Flake Fountain is...
Flake Fountain, I know. It's beautiful.
He's a very flaky person. He's not, yep, he's very shallow and...
he's a professor of genetics from a tiny or teeny university.
Right.
You know? and the story is about him, granted, but it's also about his best friend. And his best friend is really who I think is the main character.
Really?
And, oh, yes. Oh, yeah. By far. And the main character, then, the one he's talking about most of the time, is Dr. Blip Courtley. And Blip is just phenomenal. Blip is that, is a professor of sociology. He's a hippie, he's a conspiracy theorist. He is married to Sophia, and they have this absolutely gorgeous relationship where they spend their time trying to come up with, question about the universe and discussing, life, the universe and everything, no pun intended.
Right.
And and tapping their foot, because that's what they do. As soon as they get excited about an idea, they get their foot tapping, which I thought was hysterical because it reminds me of that bunny from Bambi, which I like.
Thumper.
Yes. So, yeah.
I'm not sure I would agree with you. I mean, I agree that, they're about what you discuss about them as, uh-huh, far as, I think, yeah, obviously they have a very good relationship with one another, those two characters.
Oh, yes,
and all
absolutely
those things. I'm not sure I would go as far as to say the Blip is the main character.
Blip is the reason why...
Now, this is a good place in the show,
uh-huh,
to mention the fact that, before we go too much farther, that if you have not read the book, there are bound to be spoilers.
Oh, yeah, well, of course, yes.
Throughout our discussion of the book, because we can't very well discuss a book,
but we're hoping
without spoiling some of the little surprises here. And
oh,
there
sure,
in
but
a book,
we're
so
hoping to excite people enough so that they're going to want to read more.
Right, but the book is written from the perspective of Flake.
Of Flake, yes.
It's a first person narrative.
Yes.
From Flake, and though I would agree obviously Blip is an important part of the story.
Oh, he is crucial.
I'm not so sure I would go as far as to call Blip the main character.
Oh, I would. Well, it starts off, you know, I mean, Blip is the one that starts it off. He's a graffiti artist, you know, I mean, on his spare time, he just goes and put graffiti all over the city. And
not all over the city.
No,
but
just on the bridge above the interstate, which by itself is hysterical.
Right.
So he goes up there and he just writes for the fun of it, uh-oh. And then some smartass the following day decides to, you know, answer him and ask when. So Blip answers just a couple of days, which comes,
that's kind of where the story takes off then, uh-huh. As far as, you know, which I think that in and of itself is an interesting plot device.
Absolutely.
Because, not just because of its uniqueness, which, I mean, it is rather unique. I've not seen anybody use that plot device elsewhere.
But it's a true story.
But is that part?
It's, yes. I mean, I think
it's based on a true story.
Yeah. Vigorito, I think somebody, I mean, I think it's written somewhere at the end of a book in one of the, you know, acknowledgement or whatever.
Appendices and whatnot.
He says that somebody, you know, close to where he lives in Ohio actually had that written on the bridge. So that gave him the idea.
Sure. So it's an interesting plot device, but for that reason alone. But beyond that, it arguably has absolutely nothing to do with what happens in the book.
No, not at all.
Arguably, it has absolutely nothing to do with the Pied Piper virus.
Nope.
Or anything that happens to Flake.
Well, yes and no, because the reply that comes after, you know, just a couple of days was written by Blip, the answer that comes out from the person who had, you know, said when, the answer comes up as now. And now is the time when you're going to start having that whole virus device plot, you know, the subplot.
Right. And it's somewhat interesting that the timing works out the way that it does.
Yes. Well, it's on purpose.
And I suppose you could make arguments based on, once you have read the entire book, and uh-huh. This is one spoiler I do not want to give out. Once you have read the entire book, I think the question then becomes, which definitely is a smart smart on the part of the author, because
yes.
It makes you want to reread the book.
Yes.
Which that's always a good thing.
Yes.
To, you know, give your reader a desire to reread the book is never a bad thing for you as an author, commercially.
It's almost a circular effect.
But once you know everything there is to know from the book, it makes you want to go back and look at it again to
yes.
see if maybe there is a somewhat esoteric connection
yes.
between what has been, you know, graffitied
uh-huh.
onto the bridge and what actually happens event-wise, where the two seem completely and totally unrelated.
Sure.
Yet they both do involve Blip.
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is why I'm thinking, you know, this is why I said that Blip is so, you know, important
and
in the story.
I would never argue that Blip is not a crucial part of the story, because
mm-hmm.
Blip is a crucial part of the story, but
oh, yeah.
I still maintain that I would call Flake the main character only because it's his narrative. Everything is
oh,
written
that
from
doesn't
his...
doesn't make him the main character.
Everything is written from his point of view, and I think it does make him the main character. I just don't think it makes him the most important character necessarily, but it does make him the main character.
And it reminds
character.
Me
He's
of
the one
the...
we're focused on.
And it reminds me of Gatsby. It's kind of written somewhat like Gatsby, you know, The Great Gatsby, because Gatsby, the main story is about Gatsby, but it's written from the point of view of Nick.
Right.
And, you know, Nick is not the main character. He's just a narrator telling the story of Gatsby. And there's a little bit of that in here, although not on
yeah,
the same level at all.
But I don't see it the same way. I mean,
oh,
the,
yeah, well, of course.
The book is not called, you know, the History of Blip. I mean, it's not...
Which is
you
too
know,
bad.
It, and, it, and it doesn't focus on Blip. At it in any way. It's just that Blip to me is not a main character. He is a plot device. To me, Blip is used by the author to move the story along. When something needs to happen, Blip comes along.
Well, let's
if
see
nothing
how.
Else needs to drive the plot points of the story, then Blip is nowhere to be seen. And that's why I say I just wouldn't consider Blip a main character, the main character.
Well, let's go into the story a little bit. I mean, because we haven't said much to it. I mean, we're going to try, I'm going to try not to give too much away, but we need to talk about the virus. The main, one of the main elements of that text is the virus. I mean, this is the manufacture of a virus. How very modern.
Right.
You know, how very, very modern.
And of course, against the Geneva Convention.
Yes, well, of course. But I mean, living in the US, you know, I mean, it actually makes you think a lot. This is a very postmodern book. I mean...
Yeah, and to be honest, I really feel like it's kind of, you know, one of... It's certainly not the first, but it's one of the first in a long series of similar stories that you see all over media.
Oh, yeah.
We've seen all kinds of films by now that use this kind of plot device as far as, yes... It's against the Geneva Convention. But despite that, and in secret, uh-huh. the U.S. military or the British military or somebody's military has been designing some sort of biochemical weapon that they lose control of and is loosed on the general populace. And now we have to deal with it.
Well, you know, I mean, it came out in 2001. I mean, you know, clearly it was written a little bit before that. But
sure.
2001, 2002, you know, 2000 was the time when anthrax was the big thing in the US.
Right.
You know, so,
like I said, it's
know.
Certainly not the first one to come
oh, no,
out by any
not.
Means. But it's one of the first before it really started getting popular. You know, certainly the computer game industry has milked that plot line for everything that it's worth. And
yes.
it certainly seems to be the zombie folk
uh-huh.
have adopted that one huge, you know,
sure.
with all the Resident Evil stuff and all the, you know, that seems to be the new, you know, even I Am Legend, all the
sure.
same stuff. It seems
yep.
to be the accepted quote-unquote new age version of
sure.
starting a zombie apocalypse would be by, you know, gen-engineered virus.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And this is why I'm saying this is a very postmodern book. I mean, by
yep.
postmodern, I mean that, you know, you have all this, you know, crisis of society, you have that whole breaking of society, that whole obsession of the self, you know. I mean, what's his name? Tibor Tiny, who is
the president?
He's the president.
He's the president of the college.
Tiny University.
Tiny University.
And the guy is hysterical. I mean, he is so funny. He's funny because, I mean, he is dying for attention, you know. I mean, he wants to be admired. You know, he's really the embodiment of that postmodern concept of, you know, look at me, you know. I mean, the postmodern generations are the one, I mean, this one. Although we kind of passed postmodern a little, but that generation where people are afraid of growing old, you know, women are so afraid of having a wrinkle, you know, I mean, heaven forbid I have a wrinkle, you know, this
right.
is that whole generation. And Tibor Tiny is definitely, you know, he's that embodiment of that. I find him hysterical. I love the man.
Well, and he is very definitely, you know, he is a rather unique individual, to say the least. And one of those people that we all know. We all know somebody in our
yep.
lives that's like Tibor.
Mm-hmm.
And he's obviously very concerned with, you know, his hair. You know, he's just
oh,
one,
yes.
of the, you know, one of those people who's, I mean, I don't remember that that's actually in the text, but, you know, he strikes you as the person that's constantly checking his hair.
Yes.
And, you know, he's constantly, you know, he takes Rogaine when he's not losing his hair.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's one of those people that just... He's so obsessed with his appearance.
With himself, I mean.
And with himself
oh, yes.
in general. He is the embodiment of narcissism.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, I find him hysterical, personally.
Which would be, you know, indicative of the name, once again. You know, the name is
yes.
Tibor Tiny, because he, in the grand scheme of things, he is a tiny person.
Oh, yes.
And he knows
he's little.
That.
He has a Napoleon
and
complex.
He's physically little, too.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I mean, in the scheme of things, as a person, he is a person that matters not at all.
Yes.
And he wants to very greatly matter.
Oh, yes.
I mean, that's the most important thing to him, is that he is somebody. And not just somebody, but somebody.
And he
but
thinks
the
he is.
Somebody.
Yep. He thinks he is, you know.
We've all known somebody like that before. And I think it's a mark of a really good author, fiction author, when they can invent a character that, you know, a body of characters in their work that are recognizable.
Sure, sure.
I mean, that may sound like a very obvious statement, But you'd be surprised how many, or maybe you wouldn't, at how many authors miss the mark on that kind of thing. And they'll create maybe a great character, but they're very Superman-esque in that they're very two-dimensional. They're a hero, and they're the embodiment of a hero. They are, you know, what's come to be known as a goody-two-shoes, and they never do anything wrong. Or, you know, when they're a bad guy, they're evil to the core. They never do anything good. There's no redeeming quality about them whatsoever, and they're completely and wholly 120% evil.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know what? I mean, that's fine. And for certain kinds of stories, that's what the story calls for. Then that's what you deliver.
Yep.
But at the same time, I'm much more impressed with an author who comes up with somebody who, though you may not like them, or maybe you do, they're still a very believable person. And they have both positive and negative qualities.
And this
too.
Is why Flake is a good character, because he's a
Flake.
Coward.
And Flake freely admits that he's really not a great person.
Oh, yeah, no.
Now, he's not a bad person, particularly. He's certainly not, he's not an enemy story. He's not an antagonist.
He's just, you know, he's just a follower, you know, I mean, he's...
But he admits that he's kind of nerveless,
you
know, and doesn't really, he doesn't want to have to think. Particularly.
Yeah.
Which I find interesting considering the guy is like one of the foremost geneticists in the country, and yet he doesn't really want to have to think very much.
No, I mean, he thinks when he's around, you know, Blip, because Blip really forces him to think, you know, because...
And frankly, more than Blip, his wife Sophia
forces
Flake to think more than...
Even their
Blip
daughter,
does.
You know, Dandelion.
Their six-year-old daughter, Dandelion.
Dandy, for short.
You know they're hippies when they name their daughter Dandelion.
And the best question she ever poses is, why are apples not called red?
And we'll get back to that, because that's obviously a major point in the book.
Sure, we'll get back to this, but I'd like to talk about the virus for a minute, because it's really, really a fantastic, you know, plot device. The virus is called the Pied Piper. I mean, hello.
You know, and if you're, you know, obviously I would hope that everyone out there would be familiar with of the Pied Piper of Hamelin. But if you're not, you know, paraphrasing in the very short, quick, and dirty version is, you know, a flautist or a piper.
Yeah.
Comes into town, the town of Hamelin, and tells the people, you know, I can get rid of your rats.
Yeah.
Because obviously in a medieval society, you know, rats are going to be a problem. They don't have very good hygiene and sewer systems back then. So he says, look, you know, you got all these rats in town. If you pay me this exorbitant amount of money,
I'll get rid of them.
I will get rid of your rats for you.
Yeah.
And so the town agrees. And thinking that, you know, he would never be able to do it.
Sure.
Which is why they agree, because they really can't afford it.
Oh, no, of course not.
So he does. He plays his pipes, and the rats all follow him out of town.
And he drowns them into the nearest river.
And he sends them into the nearest river.
Yeah.
And they drown.
So he comes
then
back
he comes
for his
back,
payment.
Says, I want the money. And they say, we don't have the money. He's like, that's okay. I'll just take your children.
No, he doesn't say that.
And... Well, I'm doing the short, quick, and dirty version. We don't have time to tell the whole story. You know, they're not going to pay him. So so he leads the children away from the town, you know, and takes the kids instead, you know.
And there's different version as to what happens to the kids. But that's basically the idea.
And some of them he sends them into the river like he did the rats. And other ones he takes them off and they live with him, you know, and whatever.
Yeah, there's like three or four different
versions. And frankly, that is where, you know, the character for Oliver came from. You know. Whatever his name is. You remember his name. Whatever the guy's name is. I don't remember his name. It's been a long time since I've read it. But the character who leads the orphans, you know, and sends them out to pickpockets and whatnot.
Oh, you mean in Oliver Twist?
Oliver Twist.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of the character.
I don't remember the character, but the character's name. But it's the...
When you said Oliver, I was thinking of that cat from Disney. Sorry.
And here you are, the big literary scholar.
That's what happens.
And you get the nobody nothing over here that remembers the Oliver Twist.
My brain is made of cheese, like Swiss cheese. Okay. I'm not French for nothing.
So you're like Quantum Leap, okay.
Yes.
All right, so anyway, so for obvious reasons, since we've already discussed the fact that the author uses names that are very tongue-in-cheek and very indicative of who they are for people, well, he does the same thing with the name of the virus.
Yeah.
Not that it's supposed to lead children into a river or anything like that, but at the same time,
it cuts communication. That's beautiful.
It destroys the idea is that it destroys a human being's ability to
talk, basically.
Well,
to recognize signs as part of a society.
It destroys your ability to interpret symbols.
Yeah.
Which includes spoken and written language.
And signs, as in, you know, waving goodbye, stuff like that. People don't recognize it as such anymore.
Right. It means nothing to you. Waving to someone means nothing to you anymore.
Yeah.
And
which is brilliant.
What an interesting virus to create.
Yeah. Isn't that great? Because, I mean, and he makes that point, which is obviously a true point, but a fascinating point, that we're all based, you know, on language. And on the other hand, you know, he says, and he's right, that language is so reductive. I mean, I'm a linguist, so I can tell you all about reduction of language. And telling you that you and I communicating, whatever comes out of my mouth and gets into your head is nowhere close to what I try to mean. Well, plus I'm a foreigner, so it doesn't help. It's an extra layer of trouble.
Right.
But it's true. So by cutting off all this communication, actually what happened is somehow the virus backfires. And I'm not fully sure I really want to talk too much about this to give,
we'll talk
you know.
About that after the break.
All right.
One of the things that I've done personally, for completely unrelated reason to this book, is recently I've been, you know, studying the centers within the brain for their various functions and seeing, you know, what happens. Because it's been a long time since I'd been exposed to that information, and I just wanted to refresh my memory, which is, you know, a funny little irony to begin with. But
refresh your memory. What
I discovered was that, you know, not only do we have several very redundant systems within the brain that take care of, you know, the same types of things. Particularly in the area of communication.
Yeah.
Communication between two human beings accesses about 4 to 5 different parts of the brain.
Yeah.
Depending on what step of communication you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are stages to, you know, as quickly as our brains operate, it doesn't seem like it would be in stages. But it is. It's just so rapid that, you know, you don't notice.
Yeah.
But obviously motor functions are happening, but that's not what I'm talking about even. Past the motor function, you speak, words come out of your mouth.
Yes. Well,
I hear them and they go in, you know, they go into my brain as auditory input, and then that's the first stage where the brain accepts the language.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes to another area of the brain that is supposed to recognize the actual speech as speech.
Yes.
And that has to happen before anything else can happen. Then once the brain goes, oh, this is speech, then it sends it to another area of the brain where it actually looks at what is this speech and tries to interpret what the words mean.
Well, that's only if you're talking about your L1, your first language. Because if you're talking about a second language, then it goes somewhere else.
But that's not what we're talking about. Because there's no evidence of that in the book.
Oh, not in that book, no.
All we're talking about is the book. So once it goes from there, you know, and the brain goes, okay, it is speech, sends it to another center where it interprets what the words are, then obviously if there are words it doesn't recognize, then it goes to a completely different area. Those words go to a completely different area for memory recall, where it starts trying to apply it to other similar words. We're not even getting into that yet. But all the words that it recognizes, it then sends to another area of the brain so that it can recognize, okay, which of these might be idioms and which of these are literal communication. There, and it goes on and on, but those stages are so rapid and so fast that we don't recognize them as the stages they are.
And that's the beauty of the book. I mean, he actually makes up words, you know? I mean, there is a lot of that in the text, too, which is very interesting. You know, because, I mean, I'm a foreigner, so obviously, to me, there's words that exist that are going to be totally foreign to me by definition. But there's also some words that he just creates, you know? I mean, he uses onomatopoeia all the time.
Right. So in order to create a virus that does that, you know, I was just trying to think then after I had done that and then applied it to this book, I was like, you know, what would it mean to try to create a virus that could actually do that? That could actually break down total communication
yep.
in speech and writing, you know, more importantly, reading. And you would practically have to access the entire brain. I mean, mm-hmm. you would end up shutting down something in just about every center of the brain in order to do that. And that's kind of a scary prospect in and of itself. But I find it funny then that, well, as you say, it kind of backfires.
Oh, absolutely.
Totally.
Totally, which is beautiful.
And we'll talk about that after the break. But I think it would. I think it would backfire. Mm-hmm. I mean, looking at the scientific method.
Looking at
the biological aspects of what would happen, I do think it would backfire.
Yeah, there's way more to it than that. I mean, that whole,
I don't
you
think
know.
Such a thing would work. But that's for after the break, which we need to hit right now. So don't touch that dial. Ink and Quill will be right back after these messages.
This is a podcast, not radio.
Oh, sorry. Don't touch that iPod. Ink and Quill will be right back after these messages.
What if they're using some other MP3 player?
Fine. Don't touch that MP3 player.
Straight download to PC or Mac?
You know what? We'll be back.
This program is brought to you by Spooky Logistics. For more fantastic audio content, visit the website at spookylogistics.com. While you're there, why not get involved in the spooky community, or even join the Spooky Asylum, which gives you access to special VIP content. Spooky Logistics. Podcasting just got a whole lot easier.
Do you ever wonder who really built the Great Pyramid? Have you seen shadows moving out of the corner of your eye and need an explanation? If so, then you need Eerie Radio. A unique combination of informative interviews and hilarious antics, Eerie Radio tackles the paranormal in a way that's never been done before. Download the show from your favorite podcatcher or listen live at SpookyLogistics.com on Sundays at 7 p.m. Eastern. Eerie Radio. Listen, learn, laugh.
So you've listened to all of Spooky shows, but you still want more? My, you are a glutton. Well, that's okay, my friend. It so happens that we have just the place for one such as you. The Spooky Asylum. Don't let the hideous laughter and maniacal screaming throw you. The Spooky Asylum is a happy place. Sunshine and daisies, as it were. Simply visit SpookyLogistics.com and have yourself committed. The Spooky Asylum. Remember, the men in the white coats are your friends.
The 1930s are dead, but the radio drama is very much alive. Spooky Logistics presents Eerie Adventures. Tales of suspense for the lover of the strange and terrifying. Download Eerie Adventures by visiting the store at SpookyLogistics.com. Hair-raising experiences await you in each petrifying half-hour tale. Eerie Adventures. It'll chill you to the bone.
All right, we're back. So, what we were talking about before the break
uh-huh.
was the fact that the virus backfires.
Yes.
So...
And it does that very nicely, and it actually makes perfect sense in a society.
And this is where the big spoilers come in.
Sorry. I apologize, people. Really, really sorry. Yeah, it backfires, and that's brilliant, because, you know, you cut all these communication devices, you know. I mean, people cannot communicate. They laugh and laugh and laugh like crazy, but basically they cannot communicate. So they recreate language. Which is awesome, you know, I mean, and I think this is what would happen in a society. I mean, I'm not a sociologist, so I have no freaking clue. But I'm assuming that because we are a society and we have to have some kind of communication device, whether it's words, signs, symbols, or whatever, if we were to just cut down you know, the whole language and everything that we do to communicate with each other, we
including symbology. There is no symbology.
Yes. Then you know, we would find a way, whether it's just, you know, whatever it would be, we would find a way to communicate with each other.
Kind of the Ian Malcolm theory from Jurassic Park of, you know, life finds a way.
Yes.
You know, that if something becomes impossible, it won't stay that way for long,
yeah,
because life will find a, and sometimes very ugly way, but it will find a way to, you know, move forward and make that happen.
But the sad part of the story is that, you know, I mean, the idea was a beautiful idea. The idea was we're going to create a virus that is going to incapacitate people to communicate with each other. So they will, you know, so we will be able to take over a country because they won't be able to defend themselves. And you know.
Yeah, basically, a group of people that cannot communicate with one another can't fight.
Can't fight, exactly. But the point is, and that's the sad, you know, the sad part of that story, is the fact that if you can recreate language where it has been destroyed, then it just means that there will always be war, because there will always be communication. What they try to do
will
fail.
Well, actually, I completely disagree with that statement.
All right, bring it.
Because in the book, and again, this is where you have to get into spoilers in order to discuss
it. Yeah, that's the sad part.
That's not what happens.
It doesn't in that one. No, it doesn't.
That's not what happens in the book. In the book, they do not recreate language. They cannot speak, and they cannot...
They recreate some kind of communication, though.
They have empathic communication,
yes,
instead, which is interesting, again, because now we're starting to get into... They start accessing areas of the brain that until then have lain dormant,
yep,
because they were unneeded. Well, now they're needed... And so all of a sudden, everyone starts acting as one accord, and they,
yes,
all start acting as one entity because they tap into almost some sort of a hive mind.
Yes, some kind of a global consciousness.
Empathic communication.
Yes.
Since they have no other way to communicate with one another, and quite the opposite becomes true. They are not interested in individuality or war. They're interested in unity and doing the same thing,
which is interesting because it goes back to modernity. That's I mean pre-modern, actually, because I mean post-modern, like I said, is the breaking down of society, the focus on oneself, and the way it,
right,
goes is pre-modern, modern, and then post-modern. So the pre-modern is basically tradition, following, everybody does the same thing, and then the modernity is looking into the future and thinking, you know, how can we today make the future better, like having some kind of a grounding in both occasions. But in the postmodern, you have no more grounding, you know, you're kind of like in the air. And here, by recreating that kind of, you know, global consciousness of everybody's doing the same thing, recreating language pretty much from scratch, then you're going back full circle to the pre-modern. It's very interesting that he would do that.
Well, I especially find it interesting because he spends so much time with Blip and Sophia.
Yes.
And
who are deep thinkers.
But also hippies. So very, very much into individualism.
Yes.
They are consumed by individualism, in fact, and they think everyone should be their own unique person, and they're almost anarchists. You know, they're stereotypical of the hippie movement, which is not at all conducive to what ends up happening.
Yes.
Because what ends up happening is that everybody becomes the same person, pretty
Spoiler.
Much. And, you know, you can't, you know, it's almost as if the book goes along promoting individualism.
And yet...
And once again, this is more backup for why I would say that Blip is not the main character and that Flake is the main character, because Flake is not an individualist.
Well, but Flake is a coward.
And he freely admits that, but Flake is a sheep.
Flake is a sheep.
He wants to follow the herd. He doesn't want to have to think. And so really, in the end, as scared to death of the consequences as Flake is, the new world, for all intents and purposes, that has been created by the Pied Piper virus...
She's somewhat apocalyptic.
...is the perfect world for Flake.
And Flake yet is incapable of pretty much living on his own. I mean, he goes to live in Blip's house. He has those will, you know, this will of individualism, but he's incapable to follow it through. I mean, he will follow the army because
and
he
frankly,
doesn't,
he
you
just,
know.
He, it's only because he envies Blip and Sophia.
I mean, oh, yeah.
He envies their life together and the fact that they're so happy and that they're able to, you know, basically stare everything horrible in the world, you know, straight in the face and laugh at it.
Yeah.
You know, and he envies that because he lives so much of his life so scared.
Oh, yes.
And they seem to just be impervious to all such things. But in the end, what happens is that they're wrong. Blip and Sophia are wrong. I mean, if you're looking at, mm-hmm. at if you're looking at the ending as some sort of moral statement.
And the
author doesn't say that.
Oh, he doesn't say much, no.
The author does not say anything about what he thinks is right and wrong. That has really nothing to do with the book. But if you look at the ending as some sort of a moral statement about society, then Blip and Sophia are wrong, too. That neither direction is the right way. Trying to get people to be sheep to follow you, you know, more of a fascism type of an idea, is the wrong way to go. And everyone being individualistic is counterproductive to society, so that's not a way to go either. And that in the end, everyone being sheep across the board with no leader, because
that could be
because,
a problem.
Because a leader is unnecessary, is the true answer. Again, this is putting words in the author's mouth, because
yeah.
the author doesn't
yes,
make
it is.
Any statement. He just writes the book and lets you take it to mean what you want.
Which is what I like about this book, you know.
And I'm not saying that that's what you should get out of the book.
Not necessarily.
But it is one interpretation you could make
that's
of the text.
Of that's one of them. I mean, yeah, there's plenty. I mean, you can take that text pretty much the way you want it. And as a literary critic, I mean, that's what I do with my spare time, I guess, so with my job.
You have spare time?
No, I don't. Are you kidding me?
I was going to say,
oh, no.
I was confused there for a minute.
No. But I mean, yeah, I mean, you can take this text and pretty much interpret it the way you want. And that's what is so beautiful about it. This is what is so interesting about it.
I do like, I do have to say one thing. I want to make sure I get this into the show. And that's that if by some minor miracle, Mr. Vigorito. Were to ever listen
yes,
to
that
this
would be
episode
fun.
Of
yes.
Ink and Quill, I would like to congratulate you, sir.
Oh, yep. Beautiful job.
Because I know for something very specific.
Okay.
I would like to congratulate him on the ability to come up with quite that many euphemisms.
Oh, yes, yes.
For playing with your own crotch. I'm shocked and amazed.
General Killjoy is...
What a great name.
General Killjoy.
General Killjoy.
Is the, you know, the military guy in charge of, you know, Pied Piper operation, basically. And he plays with himself, for lack of a better word, a lot. You know, I mean, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, he pretty much what I've heard about, I believe it was Scorpios,
uh-huh.
That tend to be obsessed with their own genitalia.
Uh-huh.
Very, very definitely, General Killjoy falls into that. But more along the lines of, you know, just I believe the author states as a reason, if you can call it such a thing, that he does this is just to. Just to reassure himself that it's all still there.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it definitely falls into that category of, you know, he is the stereotypical negative portrayal.
Yes.
Of a military leader.
Yes.
Who is, you know, obsessed with phallic symbols
mm-hmm.
and...
Am I the man? Is it still there?
Right,
you know,
and basically off? Has this giant internal need to... you know, have the biggest penis.
Yeah.
You know, that,
so
that
he makes sure it's there.
Everything, you know, excuse the term, but, you know, everything is a big pissing contest to him.
Yes, absolutely.
And so to him, you know, he needs to have the biggest one in the group.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so he's always, you know, his hand is constantly
on it.
on it or around it. And
picking at it, you know, touching it, squeezing it. Touchy, squeezy.
So I find that just the number of euphemisms is phenomenal. And to be honest, I don't think he really repeats one.
Think so either.
I don't think there's one repetition.
I don't think so either.
And I'm sorry, but that's worth mentioning.
Yes, that's very true.
Because it is one of the most hysterical things.
That is very true.
And about the time you think he's dropped it, he sneaks another one in on you. And,
oh, of course.
It's quite hilarious.
I do like I don't know if the author, you know, Vigorito, has particularly read No Exit by Sartre. But to me, there is when everybody's just observing the subjects. I mean, I don't want to talk too much about it, not to spoil it. But there is a moment when, you know, the people in charge of the virus are observing the people who are supposed to be infected.
Right.
And it gave me, as I was reading all these pages of description of, you know, kind of looking onto it, I had that, you know, No Exit idea coming into my head. No Exit is a play by Sartre, and it's basically three people who are dead, and they're in hell, which for Sartre doesn't mean anything, but still pretty much being on Earth, because he was, you know, an atheist. He didn't believe that there was anything after death. And they are there, and it is a triangle, because every one of them seeks recognition from the one that they cannot have. So Garcin seeks recognition from Inès, who seeks recognition from Estelle, who seeks recognition from Garcin. And it goes like this in circle. And I kind of had that feeling reading those passages where you have those three people who are being observed as the subject that have been infected by the virus and the way they interact with each other. It's really interesting. It's very circular. This is a very circular book.
And it is. It's one of those things that, you know, you... I don't know. You just say, Vigorito, I really enjoy his ability to do exactly what you're saying as far as, you know, to go around and come back.
Yes, I like that a lot about him.
It's not always necessarily easy to do that.
No, of course not.
Now, sometimes, I'll be honest, you know, and I would hope most authors would be honest. Sometimes you just get lucky.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I'm not saying that's what happened in the case of this book. I'm just saying that sometimes you get lucky. Sometimes a story just comes around on you.
Well.
As you're writing it, it just comes right back around to where it was, and you're like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Like, oh, well,
and
yeah,
all right. You didn't expect it. It's just the way it happened.
Oh, hello, beginning. I thought you were the end.
Right, yeah. and those make for some interesting stories generally, too.
It makes for very, very 19th century. I mean, I study 19th century a lot, and it makes for very 19th century way of doing things where you send the reader back to the beginning because you want the reader to think, not to be passive readers, but to be thinking. And that's definitely one of those books where you have the reader that just cannot be passive.
And I think that's a good point to make. About this book is that you definitely need to be a more aggressive, intellectually at least, need to be a more aggressive reader to probably thoroughly enjoy this book.
Yes, that's true.
Now, you can get some surface thrills from reading the book, but it's really not that kind of fiction.
And that's what I personally like about this book. You kind of have to be somewhat well read to catch the little, you know, the little what's the word in English? The little references.
Yeah,
to,
and the little nuances and whatnot.
Yeah, all the. But then again, you can read the book without, and you're not going to miss out that much.
No, but it. I have this sneaking suspicion. That you know, this book was a New York Times bestseller.
Yes.
And to be honest, I find that surprising.
Okay.
I don't want to insult my fellow Americans. That's not my intention. But at the same time... Now, also, I don't know really what it takes to make the New York Times bestseller list.
Usually the bestseller, New York Times bestseller list, I've read some of them. They're not, mass media type reading at
and
all.
That's really kind of what I'm getting at, is this is probably not a book.
I mean, some of them are, granted.
Just a couple of days is really not a book that I think would appeal to the general American audience.
No. I mean, I it was referred to me by a friend who basically threatened murder if I didn't go and buy it.
Right.
You know, so it's definitely something to be read.
I'll give you an example of what I mean. Alexandre Dumas.
Uh-huh.
Obviously a very celebrated author.
Yeah.
I dearly love some of mm-hmm. his books. Now, I'm talking about senior here, not junior. But after reading, you know, The Three Musketeers is a story, probably his most famous, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's been reproduced in so many ways.
Yeah.
Poorly, I might add, usually. Mm. And that's my point. Why is it poorly reproduced? Because all these reproductions tend to be American.
Okay.
There's a couple that are not. But most of the reproductions tend to be American, and therefore they murder the story.
They're reductive.
Well, why do they feel they need to murder the story? Because Americans would not like the end.
Well, yeah, I'll give you that.
The general American audience, we are a nation who loves to root for the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
We're a nation that's in love with the happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
We're not like the Greeks.
Or the French.
Of old. We don't like the tragic ending.
Yeah.
We're not like the French. We don't relish the non-ending.
Yes. I quite enjoy the non-ending.
Which Americans don't.
I know.
We in general, I'm talking, obviously, generalization here.
Oh, sure.
We want to know. We want to know what the end is. That's why I was kind of surprised X-Files was such a popular show.
Uh-huh.
Because you never found out anything on that show. There was never any
love
answer.
That show. Beautiful.
So I was kind of shocked that it did so well because, uh-huh. you know... In general, people want answers. They don't want to be left hanging. And that's definitely this kind of book. I mean, just
yes.
a couple of days. It's not like it doesn't end. I mean, it has an ending.
Mm-hmm.
But the ending is very dissatisfying if you're looking for the, and that's the way it happened type of ending. It's
yeah.
just it just isn't that. It's one of those books that it just ends with a new beginning.
Yes.
And now it's up to you to imagine how you think the rest of the world is going to react or what's going on in the rest of the world. You don't know.
Uh-huh.
And it's up to you to imagine what the real continuation of the story would be, but it definitely leaves the ending as a non-ending.
Yes.
It's not an end, it's a new beginning.
It's a new beginning.
So,
and it is so true with society,
be forewarned,
you know?
Of that. And if you don't like that kind of a story, I would still say read it,
uh-huh.
because it's not quite as bad as some are, where it's just a like almost like it stops mid-sentence, and you don't even know, and you're just lost. You know, it's not as bad as one of your favorite films, Mulholland Drive, which makes absolutely no sense.
That's my favorite movie.
It's not that bad. It's just, you know, that, you know, it does not have a... It has a definitive ending to the events that take place in the novel.
Yeah.
But it does not give you a very satisfying, and that's all that happened. No, it's kind of one of those, and then it's up to you.
But see, I'm a freak like that. I'm satisfied by being a
part of it. I don't see a freak like that, but... But and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing either. I mean, because life has no real end.
That's the
idea. So, you know, even if someone dies, life in general continues on. So it's not like, you know, that's going to be the end of the story. It's just the end of someone's story.
And as a reader, I am satisfied by the fact that I have taken part in that story. And at the end, they have opened it for me. And I have been the one deciding what I thought was the best ending. So
right.
I'm happy. I'm a happy camper. Do you want to say a couple of words of books of Biyadou real quick?
Yes, I wanted to get to that before we end, and we are going to have to wrap up here pretty quick. But I did,
yes, sir.
I did want to mention that there is this, I don't know, section? I mean, they're like almost little mini chapters.
Yes.
Throughout the book that I'll let you describe what they are, but, you know, remember, no spoilers on this one. Just let them know in general what the kind of thing
okay.
is.
Okay. All right. Well, we do find out where they come from. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
Okay, good. So, well, basically, it's conversation between two people.
Entities.
Some kind. Yeah, called Rosehip and Sweetlicks, I think it is.
It's Rosehips and Sweetlick, yeah.
Yeah. And and they talk kind of, you know, endlessly, and you have this dialogue between these two. And they I don't know how to describe it. I mean, some of those dialogues are going to be only linguistic based, so they will throw right. onomatopoeia at each other. But most of the time, you know, they talk about philosophical stuff. It's quite metaphysics / philosophy.
And they are definitely, I would say more often than not, it's linguistic masturbation. I mean,
yes.
That's more often than not, that is what it is. The two of them are just playing with language and turning one another's words on them.
That's, yes.
And turning well-known phrases upside down, inside out, and on their ear. And
which for a foreigner like me is fantastic, because...
No, it's not just foreigners. I mean, if you enjoy good use of language, it's a very fun time.
It's a very fun time. Well, what I mean by foreigner is that when I see an expression that I don't know, then I just tend to look at it word to word. It makes no sense.
Literal translation means very little.
Means very little. And this is kind of what they do. You know, they just play with all this. And I think this is really fun.
Yeah,
it's a fun time.
They'll take an idiom and turn it into a literal statement if it suits their purpose, and vice versa.
And run from it. And you know,
then,
and run with it.
Yeah, and then run with it and... you know, twist it into a completely
yes.
different conversation than what it just was a second ago, and then they're off and running. And so conversation topics change on a dime constantly, because they'll twist the meanings of words into, now they're in a completely different conversation than they were in before.
Yes.
Now, having said all of that, the conversations between these two entities are not very long.
Oh, no. It's just a page and a half
it's
max.
It's generally a page, or, like you say, a page and a half maximum. But
yep.
usually it's only a half page to a page.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it'll be as much as four sentences, and
yes,
that's it.
Yes, yes.
But wild. I mean, really weird.
Really cool. Really
stuff.
Cool.
But and the whole time, I mean, if you're a down-to-earth reader like
uh-huh.
I am, then the whole time you're going, what the hell is going on?
And when
you know,
you are
like, what is this? What does it have to do with anything? Because it seems completely irrelevant. Like, it has nothing to do with the story. It's not connected with
nope.
anything that's going on until the very end. And I am pleased to say that one, he explains it in the end so that
yes.
you're not left going, what the hell was that whole, you know, Bill of Dude, you know, crap all the way through the book?
But see,
what did that
have
to do with
when
it?
When you're a reader, you know, kind of heads in the clouds, head in the clouds, take whatever comes to you.
Hopefully
like,
well, you don't have your head in the clouds.
Not recently. I mean, last week, yes, but not today. So, so you know, I mean, this is the kind of thing that I really enjoy. You know, I mean, for you, you kind of need an explanation for this kind of thing. I don't.
I'd like one, yes.
I don't. I just enjoy the fact that it's there. I like it.
Well, you go on liking it.
I like it.
All right, well, we're going to have to wrap it up for this this installment of Ink and Quill. So again, the book's name is Just a Couple of Days.
Yep.
Should be able to find it easy in paperback.
Oh, yeah, it's easy.
Tony.
Tony
Vigorito.
Vigorito. For people who like language, you know, that's the book for you.
Right. And next time,
mm-hmm.
we're going to hit Dean Koontz.
Lightning.
It's one of our Dr. Hott and I's favorite authors.
Yes,
Dean Koontz, very good author. So we're going to be hitting up his book Lightning, written in the 80s, if I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll have to tune in next time for that.
Absolutely.
So this has been the first episode of Ink and Quill. Hope you guys enjoyed it. If you'd like to check out more about Ink and Quill, or join a forum on the subject, or you would like to find out other shows that are also produced by Spooky Logistics, then all you have to do is go to SpookyLogistics.com and join the community there and
join
start
the
getting
fun.
Involved.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot, guys. We'll see you next time.
Bye. Have fun.
You've been listening to Ink and Quill. Tune in next time and hear Dr. Hott say,
a banana a day keeps the baboons away.
Ink and Quill, turning literature inside out.